It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here. We'll talk about one of the longest DDoS attacks ever. It's been going on for 5 days. Who's behind it and what they are doing. We'll also talk about Patch Tuesday's mixed blessing. The 10th, count them, 10th zero-day patch for Chrome this year alone. And then a look at how a very powerful pen testing tool is being adapted by hackers to attack you. It's all coming up next on Security Now.
Podcasts you love
from people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 837, recorded Tuesday, September 21st, 2021. Cobalt Strike. Security Now is brought to you by CrowdStrike. CrowdStrike harnesses the power of every click, every action, every ally to grow stronger and stop cyber threats before they can stop you. Join the fight and experience the power of Falcon Platform free today at CrowdStrike.com/twit. And by Worldwide Technology and Fortinet. When was the last time your company updated your security strategy? Are your business assets protected? WWT combines strategy and execution to secure your organization and drive business outcomes. Visit WWT.com/twit to get started. And by Udacity. Gain in-demand tech skills in as little as 3 months with Udacity's part-time online tech courses. Visit Udacity.com/twit and get 75% off any program with the code TWIT75, limited time offer. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover your security, your privacy, your health, welfare, and well-being online with Steve Gibson of GRC.com. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Leo. Great to be with you again. This is our Tuesday after the second Tuesday, so we've got some news about how that went. What's really interesting is that right now, as we're recording this, we're in the fifth day of a continuous, devastating, still ongoing DDoS attack against the latest in a series of several VOIP service providers. So we're going to talk about that. As I mentioned, we're going to also check in on how last Tuesday's Patch Tuesday went. We've got a welcome feature of Android 11 that Google has announced they're backporting through to all the way back to Android 6. But I'm a little unsure about exactly how that works. We'll talk about that. We catch up with Chrome's patching of two more new zero-day vulnerabilities and the attacks on those being zero days. We look at the Pwnage email I received from Troy Hunt's Have I Been Pwned site. Was GRC pwned? I then have a quick sci-fi reminder for the end of the week, a SpinRite update, and a fun-related YouTube posting. Then we're going to wrap up by introducing the latest weapon, in the malign perpetrator's arsenal. It is a powerful commercial tool known as Cobalt Strike, which unfortunately has been taken up rapidly by the underworld. And since I'm seeing increasing mentions of it, I thought we ought to put Cobalt Strike on all of our listeners' radar so that when we touch on it in the future, as unfortunately I'm afraid we're going to be, everyone will be nodding sagely. Ah, yes, Cobalt Strike. We know about that from episode 837.
Cobalt. I have a CrowdStrike ad, actually.
Very different.
Not the same. Very different. In fact, CrowdStrike might help you against Cobalt Strike. Let's talk about CrowdStrike. We've talked about it, of course, on the show many times. They're very well known. And actually, yep. I think they have a unique kind of value proposition. So you know, I don't think I have to tell you, ransomware is a bit of a problem these days. We talk about it all the time here on TWiT, but it's not just ransomware, it's malware, it's all DDoS attacks, all kinds of threats on the internet. And if you're in business, you've got to be a little worried, you know. And what the one thing you don't want to have to do is make the decision: do I pay the ransom for ransomware, or do I let them take everything? There is a third option. Defeat your adversaries before the fight even starts with CrowdStrike. Why is CrowdStrike better? Because they use the wisdom of the crowd. Over 1 trillion data points every day, 7 trillion every week from all the users of CrowdStrike. It's like they've got feelers out everywhere monitoring malware, bad activity on the internet. You've got allies in every corner of the web. And they're all there to help you stay safe. A secure future is going to demand a shared defense. That's why CrowdStrike's Falcon platform uses their threat graph. That's what they call it. And it's a great name for it if you think about it. Their threat graph power by advanced AI to analyze behavior. Now, the key with AI to work, of course, is the bigger the data set, the better, the smarter the AI. 1 trillion data points a day. That's a pretty big data set. They're analyzing behavior on everything. Your devices, your servers, your cloud workloads, and that of every CrowdStrike user. And they're finding the threats and they're stopping them. And they're constantly evolving, constantly on top of what's happening because of this. CrowdStrike's Falcon platform delivers the industry's most powerful set of tools to fight today's most sophisticated cyber attacks. And it's all delivered. You might think, oh, I don't want that big, heavy. No, no, no. It's a lightweight, intelligent agent coming through the cloud. Forrester did a study on Falcon Complete. They found it returns 403% ROI, 403% return on investment. And I'll say they give you 100% confidence. I had a great conversation, actually, the other day with their CTO. His name is Michael Sentonas. And, of course, the first thing I wanted to know when I talked to him is how the threat graph system works, how it's a collaborative platform.
It's the crowd in CrowdStrike, and that's the concept. You know, the original vision was to build the fundamentals. It was to bring in all of those signals, that telemetry, and the more data we get, the more information that we have, we can use that to protect all of our customers in real time.
It's really quite inspired. CrowdStrike harnesses the power of every click, every action, every ally to grow stronger every minute and stop cyber threats before they can stop you, even the latest one, even the zero day, because they know about it before anybody else. Falcon Complete stops breaches every hour of the day through expert management, threat hunting, monitoring, remediation. It's backed by CrowdStrike's breach prevention warranty. You'll like this. If you're a managed customer of Falcon Complete, you'll get a warranty covering up to $1 million in the event of a breach. I like it. That means they're very confident, doesn't it? Terms and conditions apply. Gartner Magic Quadrant named CrowdStrike a leader for endpoint protection for 2021. You owe it to yourself, at least, because this is a unique way to handle it and a very effective way. Find out more. Join the fight. Experience the power of Falcon Platform. And you can do it free right now. CrowdStrike.com/twit. CrowdStrike, CrowdStrike, crowd, you know. The wisdom of the crowd. Strike. Let's strike at them. com/twit. CrowdStrike. What we've built together is worth defending together. And I thank you so much, CrowdStrike, for the work you do and for support and security now. And thank all of you listeners for supporting us by going to that address. CrowdStrike.com/twit. Picture of the week time, Steve.
Indeed. Okay, so I figured it was after I saw this, we had to share it. It was only fair as a counterpoint to all of those horrifying and in many cases confounding wiring closet pictures that we were showing there for a while. This is as far to the opposite end of that spectrum as you could find. I titled this "Give That Person a Raise." This just, I can't describe.
It's like verbally. A laced-up shoe. There's bundles of, by the way, excellent choice in color.
Yes.
The kind of teal cables.
Yes, and white plastic tie wraps.
They perfectly spaced.
and circular, so the bundles are round.
Yes.
You know, and It's just and first one comes in from the on the top from the left. Second one comes in, drops below it, goes to the right. Third one comes in from the left again, slipping behind the second and the
sneaker.
Fourth.
It's incredible.
It's first of all, this is not whoever did this. This is not their first wrap up of these things. Yeah. I did note that it looks like it's coax as opposed to a multi-stranded Ethernet cable. Looked at it really closely. I think I'm seeing coax, video like video terminations. So I don't know what this is, but still, you could certainly do this with standard, 10 base style Ethernet wiring. Although I think this isn't, but just a beautiful piece.
Yeah, this
of
looks
work.
Like a switcher, like the kind we use. And
yes.
I have to say, Russell does a pretty good job, but this guy is definitely flexing.
It's world class. And notice that you don't even see the plastic bumps of the top. Well, okay,
there's
one.
There, but you don't. He's made it behind the.
Yes. Yeah. He clearly deliberately rotated them so that they're behind the main vertical bundles. It's just just a piece of work.
It looks like a competition, frankly. It's pretty impressive.
It does. I was going to say, maybe you don't want to give the guy a raise because it may have taken about a year and a half to put this thing together. And it's like his boss is like, are you done with that thing yet? No, sir. I had to tear it all down and start over because we added a wire. It's like,
oh, God. Yeah. Oof.
And that's the lesson I learned is it's always fun to tie all this stuff down, but it makes the installation brittle because you do need to move things around sometimes.
Right.
And this is a little hostile to that. So let's hope somehow they don't have to do that.
I always use Velcro for that reason.
There you go. Okay. So the DDoS attack on VOIP.ms. That's their domain name. After last week's podcast discussing the history, evolution, technology, and countermeasures of the Internet's denial of service attacks, many of our listeners tweeted to let me know of later in the week. It began on Thursday, of an ongoing multi-day attack against the company VOIP.ms. And they are, as their name suggests, a voice over IP provider whose website states has about 80,000 customers. Okay, now that was on last Thursday. Sadly, I don't know how many they have still. Several of our listeners tweeted, are among their customers. I had some DM traffic going back and back saying, who were telling me about this. And I said, and that they were speaking in the DMs as if they had no phone service. And indeed, that is the case. They were dark with their phone service. So until last Thursday, VOIP's Twitter stream had occasionally posted an advertisement to discuss and promote the various benefits of voice over IP services. For example, on Monday, beginning of the week, on the 13th, they happily tweeted the rhetorical question, are you looking for a proven growth lever for your business? Are you making full use of cloud communications? Read this article and discover all the advantages offered by this technology. And then in their tweet, they link to something. So that was on the Monday. On the 16th, they tweeted, quote, and this is at the leading edge of this attack. We're aware, they weren't aware yet of what. They tweeted, we're aware of an issue that's keeping our customers to properly reach our website. There's a team actively working on the issue as we speak, and we expect it is fixed shortly. Thanks for your patience. So, did somebody trip over a wire? We don't know. A bit later, we continue to work with our provider as our top priority, and we'll be ready to provide a postmortem of this event once the service is reestablished. Thanks for your kind understanding, and please stay tuned! And then, After further investigation, our service provider confirmed they are currently facing a network attack resulting in a denial of services. For all practical purposes, this is making our domain name, and then it's https://voip.ms, unreachable at the moment. And then, for those of you who kindly switched from host name to IP address and are within the U.S., we have made changes in the configuration with our upstream carriers to mitigate the issue for incoming calls as well. So they were beginning to play one of the games that people who, and as we know, I have too much experience with being on the receiving end of these things myself. You know, one of the things you do is, this was back in the Vireo days when they were my ISP, and I had a great relationship with them. And so, you know, we'd change grc.com's IP address. And so then change DNS, which would propagate, and for a while the attack would go away because it was still attacking the old IP, but inevitably it would catch up with the change. So, you know, changing IP addresses was one of the games back then. They said, in another tweet, if you need to access your customer portal, you may be able to do so by adding a DNS entry to your local host. And what they meant was your host's file. They said, our public website and customer portal IP address is 173.231.187.61. See detailed steps below on how to do this for a Windows computer. And then they provided instructions. Okay, so this attack continued without let up from Thursday throughout the weekend. Then Monday, yesterday morning, they tweeted, we want to assure you that all our energy and resources are being put into fighting this ransom DDoS attack, which is the first time they made any reference to ransom. A little after 11:30 a.m. yesterday, Bleeping Computer, that was tracking this, posted some news. They wrote, threat actors are targeting voice over internet provider VOIP.ms with a DDoS attack and extorting the company to stop the assault that's severely disrupting the company's operation. VOIP.ms is an internet phone service company that provides affordable voice over IP service to businesses around the world. On September 16th, 2021, VOIP.ms became the victim of a distributed denial-of-service attack targeting their infrastructure, including DNS name servers. As customers configured their VOIP equipment to connect to the company's domain name, the DDoS attack disrupted telephony services, preventing them from receiving or making phone calls. As DNS was no longer working, the company advised customers to modify their host's file to point the domain at their IP address to bypass DNS resolution. However, this just led the threat actors to perform DDoS attacks directly at the IP address as well. To mitigate the attacks, VOIPMS moved their website and DNS servers to Cloudflare. And while they reported some success, the company's site and VOIP infrastructure still have issues due to the continued denial-of-service attack. An announcement posted to the VOIPMS website says, quote, a distributed denial-of-service attack continues to be targeted at our websites and POP servers. POP is point of presence, meaning the servers and services where they're delivering their VOIP. They said, our team is deploying continuous efforts to stop this. However, the service is being intermittently affected. We apologize for all the inconveniences. Bleeping Computer continues, at the time of this writing, the site is bouncing back and forth between being accessible and displaying 500 internal server error. Today, customers continue to experience issues with their telephone service, including loss of service, dropped calls, poor performance, and the inability to forward lines. On September 18th, Bleeping Computer writes, a threat actor using the name Reval claimed responsibility for the attack and posted a link to a ransom note posted to Pastebin. This ransom note has since been removed from Pastebin, but Bleeping Computer was told it asked for one Bitcoin, or approximately at the time, $45,000, to stop the DDoS attacks. Soon after their original tweet, the threat actors raised their extortion demand to 100 Bitcoins.
Oh. Yeah. Oh boy.
Or approximately $4.3 million at the time.
They realized what they had here.
Wow. Yeah. The customers' responses to the attack against VOIP.ms have been mixed. Some feel that VOIP.ms should pay the ransom to restore services before they themselves do not lose customers, meaning the customers of the companies who are using VOIP.ms's services. At the same time, other VOIP.ms customers are vowing to stick with them and telling the company not to give in to the ransom demand. There's been lots of dialogue over on Reddit about this, with a lot of customers saying that, you know, they give up. They waited out the weekend. They're jumping ship because, like, what's in it for them to stick around? Bleeping Computer has contacted VOIP.ms with questions regarding the attack, but has not received a reply. And you can imagine the VOIPMS folks have their hands full. It strongly appears also that this is only the most recent component of a larger campaign. Earlier this month, multiple VOIP providers in the UK were very similarly targeted. The site Unified Communications, www.uctoday.com, posted the news of the DDoS attacks in the UK 2 weeks ago, and I'm going to share what they wrote because everyone will note the similarities. They wrote, at least three UK VOIP providers have been hit by a DDoS attack, according to the Cloud Communications Alliance, the CCA. In an email sent this morning, CCA said it has learned of a, quote, sophisticated, specific, and ongoing attack, unquote, believed to be from Russian cyber criminal organization Reval. We'll talk about why I think this is not the case in a minute. Two providers revealed they were victims of the attack last week, but the third company was not named by CCA. Pool-based VOIP Unlimited said the attack on its core network started on August 31st and was continuous for 75 hours. An update from this firm this morning said it did not observe any further attacks over the weekend. London-based VOIP Phone reported its attack at the same time and said this morning that its services are fully operational with traffic being closely monitored. Both firms saw their services disrupted over a 3-day period. CCA said that the culprits were demanding ransom starting at one Bitcoin but quickly increasing. The attack involves hammering a company's network with traffic of between 100 and 450 gigabits per second, often for up to 24 hours on multiple occasions. It starts with an attack on IP addresses used for SIP, ingress, and egress, but then migrates to other services. CCA said the attack is capable of evading some typical DDoS prevention measures. VOIP Unlimited Managing Director Mark Pillow told the Register at 2 p.m. 31 August, VOIP Unlimited's network was the victim of an alarmingly large and sophisticated DDoS attack attached to a colossal ransom demand. UK Comms Council have communicated to us that other UK SIP, SIP, of course, is Session Initiation Protocol. That's the VOIP protocol. Providers are affected and identified them as a criminal hacking organization called Reval, who appear to be undertaking planned and organized DDoS attacks against VOIP companies in the UK, unquote. Okay, so what's interesting about all this, the RPS, the requests per second attacks, and their mitigations, which we covered last week, which Cloudflare and others are able to provide, that is, mitigations to request per second attacks, are extremely specific to filtering web requests being made by web browser clients. In fact, anybody, sometimes when you go to a site behind Cloudflare, and I'm trying to think of several, but no mind jumps to mind. Brian Krebs' site, for example, you'll sometimes get like an intercept page, which will say, you know, one moment verifying your browser, and then you right. proceed to the site.
We've all seen that a lot. I just went to VoIP.ms's site, and you have to do a captcha, and it says, you know, hold on a second, blah, blah, blah. But it's still up.
Okay.
It's weird that they would attack the site and the POPs. Those wouldn't be the same address.
Probably not. Because the POPs, SIP is an HTTP carried protocol, but not web. It's just right. It just uses the HTTP protocol.
Right.
And what we did read was that the attacks do tend to hit their VOIP infrastructure first, and then I guess just to sort of annoy people. Now, one reason of bringing down the web interface is that the customer portals, which is what they would use to migrate their service away, are web hosted. So by attacking the provider's web interface, that would be preventing people from getting to their own client portals and thus moving themselves somewhere else. Anyway, so the problem is that the protections that we have for the web-based request per second attacks, and you just talked about them, you know, having that odd intercept page, which is no doubt running JavaScript on the browser in order to positively confirm that it is a web client that wants to connect and not somebody just making bogus queries. And especially if you had a captcha, you know, there's yet again another mitigation up in front before you're able to proceed. That would all be there to block, you know, a serious incoming attempt. There is no provider of large pipe VOIP protocol DDoS protection, and that's the key. So it has apparently dawned upon some miscreants somewhere that attacking the non-web servers of the internet's global VOIP providers would be a new revenue source for extortion demands. They're probably not wrong, unfortunately. You know, I agree with everyone that nothing about this sounds like the true Reval gang. The Reval gang conducted themselves with some professionalism. And first of all, you don't post an extortion demand on, or Reval doesn't post it on Pastebin. You know, that's not the way Reval operates. They also don't escalate from one Bitcoin to 100. That, again, this just it sounds
like
it sounds like a group who are wanting to ride on Reval's name without it any other way being Reval, and they've clearly got a big botnet. There's no doubt about that. That, you know, they've got a significant botnet. And unfortunately, we are in a world now, as we talked about last week, where big botnets are not uncommon. And what's occurred to them is that the anti-DDoS defenses are not yet defending VOIP. And you can imagine that there are lots of other internet-based services that may be mission critical for which there are not yet any specific attack preventions. So I was curious about where we are today, this morning. So I checked in with VOIP.ms's Twitter feed, and I found the following. They said, "We want to assure you that all our energy and resources are being put into fighting this ransom DDoS attack. We do feel grateful to count on your patience and understanding on these unfortunate events. Please stay tuned on our social media feeds for further updates. Thank you." They said, "Our entire team are working 24/7 on implementing all the required measures in order to have the service back up and running. We definitely understand your current level of frustration, but please, due to the current circumstances, we cannot disclose our action plan at this time. Don't doubt we are definitely using all internal and external resources that can be used in situations like these, and that soon as this event is over, your service will be just like you used it before the attacks." And then they added and finished, "All the team at http://voip.ms continues to work hard on recovering all services as soon as possible. With the help of internal and external specialists, all efforts and..." Okay, blah, blah, blah. They said, "Multiple changes have been applied in order to improve connectivity and reliability, and we have observed positive changes in certain areas of the service. The following services have been recovered and are fully functional at the moment of this post: SMS, MMS, recordings, call recordings, conference recordings. Please continue following our social media channels and issue tracker to not miss any important updates." Okay, so it sounds as though actual VOIP calling remains offline due to this attack. They have messaging and playback of previous recorded audio working, but apparently not real-time interactive calling 5 days downstream. And of course, the great danger to them is that VOIP services don't come with a great deal of customer lock-in. So some percentage of their previous 80,000 customers, all of whom will have been without mission-critical VOIP services since last Thursday, may be unable to tolerate this outage and will port their numbers to another VOIP carrier. I know that because it's all in the public transaction log. There's a lot of conversation about this with people, you know, talking about how, who they went to and what they had to do to get there and blah, blah, blah. So, I mean, they're losing customers as this attack goes on.
It's exacerbated a little bit because it looks like they touted anyway on their webpage, no contract. So if you're month to month, it's very easy to move on.
Yep.
But I would guess for that reason, I don't know, but I would guess this is not a big enterprise VoIP solution. This is probably used by a variety of people for something simpler. So,
Patch Tuesday's mixed blessing. This being the third Tuesday of the month, as I mentioned at the top of the show, we're able to get some perspective on what last Tuesday's monthly Patch Tuesday wrought. And wrought likely describes the mental state of at least a few of the industry's IT professionals following last Tuesday. It occurred to me that the well-worn term side effects is apropos for labeling things that go wrong after one of Microsoft's monthly patch batches are installed. Like a powerful pharmaceutical drug that a doctor prescribes, the application of the month's patch updates attempts to fix things that really do need to be fixed. But also, like so many powerful pharmaceuticals, there can often be unwanted side effects to make the patient or the IT administrator think twice before swallowing the pill. On the you really do need to take this pill side. Last week's batch of updates fixed a total of 86 vulnerabilities, two of them being 0 days actively exploited ITW, which you may recall is our recently coined abbreviation, and we didn't coin it, the industry has, in the wild. The demographic breakdown of those was one denial of service vulnerability, two security feature bypass vulnerabilities, 8 spoofing vulnerabilities, 11 information disclosure vulnerabilities, 16 remote code execution vulnerabilities, and 27 elevation of privileges vulnerabilities. The biggest news was that, as we hoped would be true, Microsoft was indeed able to get that nasty MSHTML 0-day patched. That was the one that the hacker forums were having a field day with, the one we talked about last week, where an ActiveX control was embedded in an Office doc that could cause IE's sort of disconnected but still present engine core to be invoked to download a malicious site's content and then compromise the system. There was no terrific workaround because the weak workarounds that had been proposed had all been worked around. So my advice and hope, I know, my God, my advice and hope was that Microsoft would be able, and I'm praying here for those I was off camera, I'll bring my praying hands up higher, was that Microsoft would be able to deal with that one swiftly, and indeed they did. Since then, we learned that the flaw was being used to download and execute a malicious DLL that in turn would install a, wait for it, Cobalt Strike beacon. And we'll know by the end of this podcast exactly what that means. Onto the victim's computer. The Cobalt Strike beacon allows bad guys to obtain remote access to the machine, allowing them to exfiltrate files and also to spread laterally throughout the network. So in other words, this 0-day, which was being exploited in the wild, was being used to download the Cobalt Strike beacon onto victims' machines. Someone who just, like, you know, Pandora's inbox said, it really can't do any harm to just open one little Office document, can it? Okay, so all that's the good news. And it provides sufficient reason for swallowing last week's update pill. But as I noted, this month's treatment was not without its side effects, which are causing, believe it or not, many networked printer users to gag. The newly introduced trouble appears to be the result of Microsoft's attempt to resolve the last remaining outstanding, that is to say, still outstanding, known vulnerability with their very troubled networked printing management. The so-called print nightmare vulnerability was, and perhaps is still, being tracked as CVE-2021-36958. After applying last week's patches, which included a fix for 36958, Windows admins began reporting wide-scale network printing problems. For example, from Microsoft's own forum under the subject Print Server and Print Nightmare Update, there was a posting last week, "This just hit us this morning too, 9/15/2021. No one can print to the network printers. I removed KB500-5613 from our server and rebooted the server, and that fixed it. Had to do that at all 8 of our branch offices, too. Microsoft updates."
Oh, geez.
I know. And this guy said, "Microsoft updates seem to be more like hackers, not professional." Somebody else wrote, "Today, 16 September 21, I got the same problem, cannot print to printer on the server. Fortunately, I read this article, and then I can assume that was happened to me. is caused by bad, all caps, Windows update. Then I checked updates history and find one update installed on 15 September. That's security updates KB500-5565. So I install it and reboot. And yes, all caps, the printer works normally. And there's others I have in the show notes. I won't drag everyone across them. But anyway, causing widespread problems. So the trouble is rather widespread. And uninstalling that security update, KB500-5565, appears to be the only way. And I should mention, that's a function of which specific version of Windows you've got. The numbers vary depending upon Windows version, so your mileage will vary. That's the only way, uninstalling the relevant update, the only way to bring network printing back online. But uninstalling the fix restores the vulnerability that was allowing bad guys to perform remote code execution and gain local system privileges. The ransomware gangs Vice Society, Magnabur, and Conti are all known to have jumped onto this flaw and are now using it as long as it lasts. And apparently it's got another month. Believe it or not, to obtain elevated privileges on compromised machines. Which begs the question, how long will it last? That's, you know, there's apparently no telling. Remember that this remaining print nightmare vulnerability was originally reported privately to Microsoft back in December of 2020. By Victor Matta of FusionX Accenture Security. One hopes that we might see a permanent and working fix for this serious flaw before we get to this December, by which time Microsoft will have known of it for a full year. A bitter pill to swallow indeed. And I keep coming back to the still-answered question, given Microsoft's virtually unlimited resources, how is it that they allow this to go on month after month after month? I don't know. Okay, one last before we take a break and I get some some water and catch my breath. Android. This is really welcome news, but I'm a little puzzled by it. Android to auto-reset app permissions on many more devices. Last Friday, Google announced that later this year, support for Android 11's privacy protection feature, which debuted a little over a year ago, it was on September 8th of 2020. That feature proactively resets unneeded app permissions for applications that haven't been used in months. That feature would be made available to billions, potentially, of devices running older Android versions, or at least to any of those which are able to update their OS. And this is great news. Very much like having old and unneeded database information, like purge itself, which we wish database information did, but it doesn't. But auto-removing unneeded, and that is to say unused permissions, is obviously terrific security. It's unfortunate that so many older Android devices may never be able to obtain this. Google boasts of 3 billion devices running Android. But the timeline demographics of their versions suggest that older versions are not rushing to update. I grabbed a beautiful chart, which is in the show notes, and the chart makes the trend clear. Android 11's adoption is growing almost linearly, but maybe slowing down slightly, as we'd expect. But nearly all of its growth is coming from Android 10. That is to say, this chart, for those who don't see it, thanks, Leo, for putting it up, the Android 11's adoption going up almost exactly mirrors Android 10's coming down, which tells us that Android 10 devices are being updated with Android 11. The lines for Android 8 and 9, being the next two most recent versions, are drooping a little. So they're being upgraded, presumably, to 11. But the older Androids are holding pretty firm. And this is what we'd expect, right? You know, in time, the batteries of those increasingly decrepit Android devices will fail, or their radios will become obsolete as cellular technologies advance and they're no longer able to find a cell tower that still supports 1G. So they'll eventually be tossed into the recycle bin, and their components and precious metals will hopefully be reprocessed to make new gadgets. But for those devices which can upgrade, this new and very useful feature will become available on all devices with Google Play services running Android from 6.0, which is API level 23, through Android 10. That is, 11 already has it, so they're catching up 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10. In their posting, Google said, "Starting in December 2021, we are expanding this to billions more devices. This feature will automatically be enabled on devices with Google Play services that are running Android 6.0 API level 23 or higher. On these devices, users can now go to the auto reset settings page and enable/disable auto reset for specific apps. The system will start to automatically reset the permissions of unused apps a few weeks after the feature launches on a device." Okay, now I studied Google's announcement and I came away unsure whether this would be enabled by default on older devices. As we know, thanks to the tyranny of the default, the only thing that matters is whether this is enabled by default. The reason this is confusing is that Google's announcement says, and I'm quoting them verbatim, quote, "This feature will automatically be enabled on devices with Google Play services that are running Android 6 API level 23 or higher. The feature will be enabled by default." Okay, so enabled on devices running Android 6.0 API level 23 or higher, the feature will be enabled by default for apps targeting Android 11 API level 30 or higher. However, users can enable permission auto reset manually for apps targeting API levels 23 through 29, which is to say prior to the API level prior to Android 11. So this suggests that even when older devices are updated, their older apps, which might remain unaware of the new support offered by Android 11 at API level 30, would not automatically be enabled. Presumably, Google was unwilling to change this behavior without the user being aware. But if I'm understanding this correctly, I think that was a mistake. You know, just ask once for all older apps. It certainly isn't burdensome for the user to say, no, I want to leave things as they are. That would not be unduly burdensome. And it's the older devices that are most in need of having their security shored up. So if I understand it right, I do wish Google had decided to be a little more intrusive, but props to them in any event for adding this feature to Android. As I said, eventually devices not running Android 11 will just disappear from the face of the earth. They'll just, they won't be usable any longer, and that'll be good, because this idea of automatically downgrading the permission of the, you know, that you gave an app a long time ago that you haven't used, yay, that's the way the world should work.
Yeah. I should point out that a lot of Android, of the older Android versions, are running on things like coffee makers. My toaster oven uses Android. A lot of my appliances run on Android.
Good
I doubt
point.
They'll ever be updated.
Good.
But then again, I don't care for app privacy because I'm not running any apps. So
right.
It's more security I worry about. And again, they're not using a browser. They're just, you know, it's just...
They're just being a little OS.
Yeah, it's just a little OS because it's free.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people do that. It doesn't even have Google services on it, I'm sure. We're going to take a break. But before we do, I want to mention that a story that broke this afternoon, you haven't had time to see it. The FBI apparently knew the Reval ransomware key for 3 weeks before telling anybody. The FBI refrained. This is from the Washington Post. Broke about noon today. Our time, refrained from almost 3 weeks for helping to unlock the computers of hundreds of businesses and institutions hobbled by a major ransomware attack this summer, even though the Bureau had secretly obtained the digital key needed to do so, according to several current and former U.S. officials. The key was obtained through access to the servers of the Russia-based criminal gang behind the July attack. Deploying it immediately could have helped the victims avoid what analysts estimate was millions of dollars in recovery costs, but the FBI held onto the key with the agreement of other agencies, in part because it was planning to carry out an operation to disrupt the hackers, a group known as Reval, and the Bureau did not want to tip them off. Also, a government assessment found the harm was not as severe as initially feared. Tell that to the folks who paid the ransom. The planned takedown never occurred because before the FBI could go after them, the hackers disappeared and shut down their server. So you can't give FBI credit for doing it, but you can mention the fact that they knew for 3 weeks what the decryption key was.
Ouch.
I'm sure you'll...
You know, there are those kinds of tough calls, right? Where, you know, where like you learn something from a channel... But you have to protect the channel's identity, so you can't make public what you've learned without endangering a resource that, you know, could potentially be even more vital in the future.
The classic case is Enigma. The Allies had cracked the Enigma machine, but if they had used the information coming through German Nazi communications to save submarines and vessels sailing across the Atlantic, it would have given away the fact that they'd cracked the code.
Well, and I love the story, right, that they contrived to make the discovery of the U-boat missions accidental.
Yeah.
Like, you know, having some weather craft fly over and like spot them
right.
And then of course and thus be able to launch an attack. So
the British spy agencies were quite inventive in that era. Just fascinating stories from that time. Anyway, I thought I'd pass that along to you.
Thank you.
The Kaseya story. They eventually did give it to Kaseya, but it took them 3 weeks to get it to them.
Wow.
Our show today brought to you by Worldwide Technology. Yes, friends, and Fortinet. Two names we know well. WWT offers security solutions and services to protect your business. Attackers are always updating their strategy. Are you? You wouldn't want to say it. Hackers have a better business model than you do. You got to keep up to date. WWT helps your organization prepare and combat next-gen threats. This is why you want to work with WWT. You want a company that has the vision, the services, the capabilities needed to deliver security controls and reduce the risk for your organization, and WWT does that. Their team provides resources and platforms to make it possible. With over 3 decades of experience, they have a proven track record to truly help you succeed. And because WWT is a big business, a well-run business, they understand that you have to pair any IT improvements, any security improvements, any security model with your business goals, with your business strategies. execution has to follow strategy. So they don't just come in and say, oh, you need to do this, this, and this. They really understand your business. They find out. They get the details. Their consultants are the best in the business. I'll give you some examples. They worked with a big healthcare company using expert knowledge, state-of-the-art tools, in-depth analysis. They even did skilled training and repetition. The healthcare organization wanted to conduct a security risk assessment of their certified electronic health record technology. WWT, besides all the training, besides the repetition, everything they did, they also found, not a surprising finding if you listen to this show, 90% of the vulnerabilities found in this system could be fixed by putting in a comprehensive, systematic approach for patching. So they did that. They did that. They fixed it. WWT worked with a retail bank to help them achieve their goal of establishing an infrastructure capable of preventing and surviving what they call a catastrophic cybersecurity event. Something like Revil, right? WWT helped them reduce system outages by 40%. And by the way, they saved money through this. Ongoing cost savings of 48% through infrastructure automation. Whether it's risk management, endpoint security, network security, identity and access management, cloud security, WWT and Fortinet know it and can do it. They're the masters, and they can help you transform your threat model. See how WWT and Fortinet can protect your business assets and intellectual property with a holistic security approach tailored specifically to you. That's what WWT does so well. Not a cookie cutter. Every single client gets personal, hands-on, very much customized service and support. And, of course, the best hardware. WWT.com/twit to get started. Let worldwide technology help you. WWT.com/twit. Please use that address so they know you heard it here. We're big fans. We've had a great partnership with them. Flew out in March of last year to see the Advanced Technology Center. I was so impressed by the team. Super smart people. WWT.com/twit. Worldwide technology. Make a new world happen. And keep the bad guys out. All right, back to Steve.
Speaking of keeping the bad guys out, Google patched the 9th and 10th in the wild 0 days in Chrome this year.
Oh, my God.
I know.
Oh, the browser is the vector for most attacks because it's what goes on in the internet. I don't think Chrome is more insecure than anything else.
Nope. It is the big target.
Right.
And as we've said, browsers are just crazy complicated now. I mean, they're elevating themselves to the complexity of an operating system. So the good news is everyone running Chrome desktop for Windows, Mac, and Linux will now find themselves running 93.0.4577.82. So the first number, 93, last one that matters, 82. And that's good news since the bad guys are scouring Chrome for any way in. And so far, they've been discovering and exploiting those ways all this year at a rate slightly better than one per month, since we're in month 9 and this is 0 days 9 and 10. Chrome's update to 93.82 fixes a total of 11 security vulnerabilities, two of them being these 0 days exploited in the wild. One is an out-of-bounds write in the V8 JavaScript engine, and the other is a use-after-free bug in the IndexedDB API. So they're both memory bugs. The release notes commented that, quote, Google is aware that exploits for CVE 2021, 3632, and 3633 exist in the wild. The 2 0-day vulnerabilities were disclosed to Google, get this, Leo, on September 8th. So Chromium gets fixed in less than a week, 5 days, actually. This makes me even more glad that Microsoft decided that they were incapable of managing the ongoing development and maintenance of a state-of-the-art web browser. They adopted the Chromium Core. thank goodness. As we know, our web browsers are today's primary attack surface, as you were just saying. We push them out onto the internet and actively solicit unknown remote web servers to download and run their code on our machine.
Well, when you put it that way, it's amazing. It's amazing it works at all.
I know. This is where we all say in chorus, what could possibly go wrong? It sounds insane, yeah. And it really is. So Lord knows that we cannot be waiting 9 months for Microsoft to get around to fixing critical problems that they've been informed of. Google takes 5 days. Thank you. Happy to be behind a Chromium-based browser.
Well, and that's the other thing. Everybody else benefits, too, because of all the Chromium-based browsers. It is the one good argument for having everybody run Chromium.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you get to multiply. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so was GRC pwned, Leo?
What?
The last time we talked about Troy Hunt's excellent Have I Been Pwned web service, I noted that not only is it possible for individuals to subscribe to the site's autonomous notifications via email in the event of that email address appearing in any new breach, which Have I Been Pwned adds to their massive and growing breach database, but anyone who owns their own email domain, like twit.tv, can similarly submit their entire domain for notification. And I did that quite a while ago. So I was interested to receive a notification on Sunday, day before yesterday, from HIBP, Have I Been Pwned, informing me that one or more email accounts belonging to GRC.com had just popped up in a new data breach. And sure enough, while gathering the cyber news of the past week to share with everyone here, I encountered the mention of that site, which had been mentioned by Have I Been Pwned as having been breached. The site was Epic, EPIK.com, which I had no memory of ever giving any email credentials to. I didn't know of it at all. And Wikipedia, however, knows about them, saying, quote, Epic is an American domain registrar and web hosting company known for providing services to websites that host far-right, neo-Nazi, and other extremist content. What? And a breach of that site had leaked some GRC credentials? So, the security industry coverage of this breach notes that Epic is the host of sites including Gab, Parler, and The Donald. And the reputable site The Record, which was tipped off of the breach on Monday, first received a small subset of samples, which was later followed by a full copy of the entire leak from an individual who claimed to be loosely associated with the Anonymous group. The group, which was proudly claiming responsibility for the breach and this extensive exfiltration. When The Record then reached out for comment last Tuesday, Epic denied the breach and the hackers' claims in an email reply. Epic wrote, quote, "We are not aware of any breach. We take the security of our clients' data extremely seriously, and we are investigating the allegation," signed Epic spokesperson. Okay, so despite Epic's denial, the data, which The Record received in full and reviewed, confirms the hackers, the Anonymous group hackers' claims. In a 32 gigabyte torrent file hosted through the DDoS secrets portal, the hackers included several SQL database dumps containing gigabytes of sensitive information such as domain ownership details, domain transactions, account details, and troves of personal data points. Okay, so presumably a subset of this massive trove of information was then provided to Troy and was added to his Have I Been Pwned database, whereupon any of those who had previously signed up for notification would receive an email, just as I had. But I still had no idea how GRC could possibly have been part of the breach of such a domain registrar and host provider.
Especially since it didn't happen.
Well, exactly. Very good point. Since, what are you talking about?
There was no breach.
We didn't lose any breach.
I don't see a breach here.
Do you see it, Margaret? No. Okay. So I went over to HIBP to see what was up. It's possible to query Troy's terrific site for any matches on a specific email address, or if one owns an entire domain, any matches against that domain. So I did that, and I found the two email addresses that had apparently been, and now I have air quotes, leaked by the breach of Epic.com. They were network-solutions-public-whois@grc.com and whois2011-1@grc.com. Whew. So it was neither I nor Sue nor Greg nor any corporate email. Returning to the emailed notification I had received from Have I Been Pwned, I discovered that the notification that Troy's site sent had provided an interesting description of the breached site along with the notification. Have I Been Pwned said, in September 2021, that is this, the domain registrar and web host Epic suffered a significant data breach, allegedly in retaliation for hosting alt-right websites. The breach exposed a huge volume of data, not just of Epic customers, but also scraped Whois records belonging to individuals and organizations who were not Epic customers. The data included over 15 million unique email addresses, including anonymized versions for domain privacy, names, phone numbers, physical addresses, purchases, and passwords stored in various formats. So, Big Hugh, that all fits.
Was Epic scraping Whois?
Yes. Though probably to spam for commercial purposes. Ugh. Those two GRC.com email addresses would have indeed been scraped from some of GRC's public ICANN domain registrations. And who knows why this distasteful-seeming domain registrar might have had them. As I wrote in the show notes, perhaps to use as spamming for, you know, commercial purposes, mm-hmm. you know, come on over here,
right.
registration solicitations. You know, because the date of registration shows, so they would know to send email addresses when your registration is close to being right. renewed.
Or to snipe your domain, maybe.
Could also be. Good point. If it doesn't get renewed, then grab it.
Yep.
Anyway, I thought it was very cool that Have I Been Pwned's proactive service works. It's the first time it's notified me since this was, it had never occurred to me. And I wanted to make sure to take this opportunity to remind our listeners of Troy's useful and 100% free service. So thank you, Troy. And whew, fortunately, that was just a weird misfire.
Yeah.
Wow. I wanted to remind our listeners that the first three installments of Apple's 10-part miniseries based on Isaac Asimov's Foundation trilogy become available this Friday, the 24th. As it happens, Lori and I had some dinner party plans, which were moved from Friday to Thursday, which worked for me, since I'd love to be able to set this Friday night aside for those like first three Foundation episodes. I don't know if they're an hour each or they 2 hours each. I don't know how long each one is, but I can't wait. It looks wonderful. And just another note, we will be needing to wait one more month for the remake of Dune, which will be appearing on HBO Max, as well as for Apple TV's release of another 10-part miniseries, Invasion, which chronicles an invasion of Earth by hostile extraterrestrials. So it's looking like the sci-fi lovers among us will finally be having some fun and some new visuals. I think that's mostly what I love about these films, Leo, is that they're just, you know, I mean, the plot lines are rarely surprising, right?
Well, you read the book, so, right? You know.
But so, yeah. I know all about,
you know
Harry,
what's going to happen.
Happening, yeah.
I can't wait. Friday. That's exciting.
Also, a note that my work on SpinRite is progressing. As I last noted, I was becoming uncomfortable with having written so much completely untested code. It's all since been tested. I decided to stop writing, to exercise and debug everything I've written. That's done. SpinRite has always incorporated Drive benchmarks. They, in fact, as for a reason we'll see in a minute, I was just reminded that even SpinRite 1 apparently did that. The benchmarks perform deliberately repetitive and non-repetitive reads to measure various aspects of a drive's physical data read and cached data performance. The benchmarks also had the benefit of giving SpinRite's new the current benchmarks that exist in SpinRite 6, what will be 6.1, giving SpinRite's new I/O abstraction system a rather thorough workout, which is precisely what it needs. So I have updated the benchmarking code to work with the new system. I was going to have to do that anyway. I decided to do it now. And I'm nearly ready to make another test release available to the SpinRite testing gang. Once the dust has settled from that, I'll finish updating the data recovery code, which was where I was when I decided to pause and make sure everything I'd written was already working. Then I'm pretty sure that the logging system will need adjusting. I've already been in that code updating things for everything that changed about 6.1, but nothing was running back then, so I wasn't able to confirm that the various new formatting things I had written were working. And while I'm sure that other stuff will come up, it really does feel as though we're sort of getting to the point where we can see the light at the end of this very long tunnel. As I had mentioned before, I've pretty much rewritten SpinRite. I underestimated the amount of work that would be necessary, but I'm glad I did, because this is the new foundation for everything going forward. And in the meantime, I have something very fun to share. A guy by the name of Adrian Black has a retro computing YouTube channel called Adrian's Digital Basement, to which a bunch of our listeners subscribe. I know that because I began receiving tweets informing me of Adrian's recent posting. A couple of Saturdays ago, Adrian was playing with a sort of amazing emulator for the very first MFM, modified frequency modulation, hard drives of the sort that the first IBM XT could have been equipped with. So this is an emulator which pretends to be an MFM drive. It acts exactly like an MFM drive, you know, 17 sectors per track and all that we had back then. And, you know, it's sort of in the way that, like, the machines that you see blinking behind me have a chip that emulates a PDP-8. And we've got PDP-11's Leo, where there's actually, a little Linux machine, behind them doing, reading the switches and blinking the lights, again, as an emulator. So this thing pretends to be a hard drive. So anyone who recalls the iconic golden-shelled 10-megabyte Seagate ST-225 will see one sitting there on Adrian's workspace. You can see it there in the middle over on the right.
The question is, why would you want to emulate this?
Yeah. Well, on the screen there to the left.
Yeah.
On the screen there to the left.
I recognize that screen.
Is an ancient version of SpinRite.
Yeah.
This MFM hard drive emulator was not transferring data very quickly. And Adrian suspects that perhaps that's because the emulator was low-level formatted with a one-to-one sector interleave. Remember, it's a drive. It's pretending to be an MFM hard drive. And, Leo, I do agree with you. Like, okay, yeah. How much time did the person who created this thing have on their hands? Okay, so if the interleave is one-to-one and that's too tight, that means there's no sector interleaving at all. But the controller he has the emulator hooked up to is not fast enough to run at one-to-one. Mm-hmm. It needs some interleaving. It's not quick enough to catch the immediate next sector after reading the previous one. Okay, so without batting an eye in this video, which is this week's grc.sc shortcut, thus grc.sc/837, Adrian fires up an ancient copy of SpinRite and has SpinRite examine the current speed and interleave, then has SpinRite optimize the drive's interleave, just like in the old days.
Oh, I remember you could do that. That's right.
Yes, and you see it actually doing it. It successively tries each interleave in turn and measures the drive's data transfer performance at each interleave setting.
Holy cow.
And then builds a correspondence table. So this week's GRC shortcut, as I noted, it will jump you 41 minutes in to just before Adrian begins to run his ancient copy of SpinRite on the emulator. Again, http://grc.sc/837. Anyway, I think I know that some of our listeners will get a kick out of it.
Could he do that with SpinRite 6? Could he, or is that too ancient a technology?
No. I took out all the interleaving code. I think 3.1 still had it. I don't remember whether 5 did. There have been requests that we've had from people who have like an 8088 or an 8086 because my newer code started using some of the instructions from the 286 or the 386 just because they're just so good. I had to use a couple. Like, well, for example, RDTSC is read the timestamp, which is provides high resolution timing information. There was some that was okay back on the 8088 and 8086, which is all I could use was what I had back then. But the point is that we can provide a SpinRite 3.1, a working SpinRite 3.1 for people who have a need that will perform interleaving. And I don't recognize, it's been so long, I don't recognize the screen, like which version of SpinRite it is from looking at the screen. So I'm sure someone will tell us.
Oh, the good old days.
I realized the
reason you might want an MFM drive is if you were trying to emulate something that thought it was going to be running on an MFM drive. So
yes, actually. Yeah. And he makes reference to that. I think he has an actual PDP-8.
There you go.
That had a hard drive controller.
Yeah.
And they're just,
So he wants to use a modern drive, but he has to emulate, or modern storage of some kind, but he has to emulate
yes.
it. Yeah, that makes sense. Exactly. So there is a good reason to do that. I mean, here you are sitting in front of a bunch of PDPs. I'm sitting in front of, I mean, obviously, we don't have any affection for the old kind of computing. Not at all.
That's right.
Of course, they're all running Arduinos and Raspberry Pis, but it's a lot easier. I don't think I could run an MFM drive on this Altair 8800. I think I'd have to run a, I don't know what, a paper tape reader. I don't know. our show today brought to you by Udacity. Udacity offers a unique part-time online education program geared for anyone looking to take their technology to the next level with specialized and exciting content. Udacity works with the big companies, Microsoft, Google, IBM, AWS, and more, to create nano-degree programs. These are degrees you can earn online that make you more desirable to these big companies. See, they know, you know, they could go to the universities and get graduates from CompSci and EE programs, but they often lack the skills that those companies need. These nano degrees are designed to give you the skills big companies want to make you a more desirable employee. And they are cutting edge. I mean, listen to the kinds of things you can study. Not just AI and deep learning, but flying car and autonomous flight engineer. Intro to self-driving cars, machine learning engineer, robotics software engineer. Udacity partners with industry leaders to make this course content, selects team leads at the top companies to be your instructors. You're getting the skills these companies are looking for, modern, up-to-date skills. If you love learning and you're always looking to learn more tech stuff, Udacity is fantastic. But I have to say, what I really admire is the way they teach. Sure, you know, you sign up for a class, you can watch the videos, these great instructors, but they don't leave it at that. You know, you're going to absorb the information, but then you have to use it. All of the learning at Udacity is project-based, active learning. In fact, you'll be expected to create projects, do homework, that you'll get code reviews from professionals in the field, just like you will in business when you get that job. But you're not alone. You're going to get There's lots of human feedback. It's a great community. There's access to mentors 24/7. So, of course, you're going to be, look, I'm not going to snow you. It's hard. You're going to be banging your head against the wall, but that's so fun. It's such a great feeling. You go, what am I doing wrong here? Mentor is going to be smart. He's going to say, well, look at that. You look at it, you think, oh, and a light bulb goes on. There is no better feeling. And the thing is, when you've done that, then you've learned it. You can take notes, watch the lectures and everything, but until you've actually banged your head against that problem, you haven't learned it. That's why I love Udacity. Their flexible schedule means you can put in just 5 to 10 hours a week, working at your own pace any time of the day or night, and still graduate in as little as 3 months. Over 14 million people in over 240 countries now use Udacity. They have awarded hundreds and hundreds of thousands of nano degrees now. This is a great way to prepare yourself for the future. And maybe you ought to, because according to the World Economic Forum, 75 million jobs, current jobs out there right now, will disappear in the next 3 years, replaced by automated processes. That could be your job. Stay ahead of the curve. Learn skills that'll keep you employed for life at Udacity.com. By the way, free courses there, flexible payment options. You know, I know, you know, times are tight, but you can learn at your own pace and schedule. And we've got a really great deal that makes these very, very affordable. I'll tell you about that in a second. But I do want to address anybody who's an employer, runs a security team, an IT department. There is also Udacity for Enterprise. If your team needs to master cutting-edge technologies like data science and AI and cybersecurity, and I know you do want them to, you listen to this show, right? You're trying to master this too. With Udacity for Enterprise, you can upskill your entire workforce with that great real-world project-based learning Udacity's famous for. Check out the Enterprise section of Udacity's website right now. Bottom line, get the in-demand tech skills you need to advance your career. The smartest teachers coming from the companies you want to work for. Udacity.com/twit. Right now, if you use the offer code TWIT75, I told you I had a deal for you. 75% off. 75% off any program. UDACITY.com/TWIT. Don't wait, though. This is a limited time offer. TWIT75 is the offer code. 75% off any program. Udacity.com/TWIT. We thank Udacity so much for supporting Security Now. And you're doing the same when you use that URL and that offer code. So please take advantage of that. This is a really good offer. Udacity.com/TWIT. Offer code TWIT75. You too can write an MFM driver in 6502 assembler. I don't think they're teaching that, actually. Okay, Steve, let's get to the meat of the matter today.
Okay, so we're going to learn about, sadly, a new tool which has fallen into the bad guys' hands, CobaltStrike.com. Proudly introduces newcomers to their quite pricey offering with the headline, Software for Adversary Simulations and Red Team Operations. So they go on to explain, this is a product that they are offering. Adversary Simulations and Red Team Operations are security assessments that replicate the tactics and techniques of an advanced adversary in a network. While penetration tests focus on unpatched vulnerabilities and misconfigurations, these assessments benefit security operations and incident response. Cobalt Strike gives you a post-exploitation agent and covert channels to emulate a quiet, long-term embedded actor in your customer's network. Malleable Command and Control lets you change your network indicators to look like different malware each time. These tools complement Cobalt Strike's solid social engineering process, its robust collaboration capability, and unique reports designed to aid blue team training. Ralph Mudge created Cobalt Strike in 2012 to enable threat representative security tests. Cobalt Strike was one of the first public red team command and control frameworks. In 2020, Help Systems acquired Cobalt Strike to add to its core security portfolio. Today, Cobalt Strike is the go-to red team platform for many U.S. government, large business, and consulting organizations. In other words, this is a top-level, state-of-the-art, high-end tool used, intended to be used by good guys to perform benign post-penetration, red team operations. The bad news is it's so good that it has also rapidly become the go-to platform for non-simulated, real-world malware post-penetration network infiltration. We've seen many examples over the years of well-designed and well-meaning utilities being commandeered and abused for malicious purposes. For example, SysInternals' Mark Rusinovich created PSExec. Its description at Microsoft, who, as we know, purchased SysInternals back in the summer of 2006, the PSExec description says, and like read this as something from the malicious perps viewpoint, they said, utilities like Telnet and remote control programs like Symantec's PC Anywhere let you execute programs on remote systems, but they can be a pain to set up and require that you install client software on the remote systems that you wish to access. Oh, how pesky. PSExec is a lightweight Telnet replacement that lets you execute processes on other systems complete with full interactivity for console applications without having to manually install client software.
Oh, don't you hate that?
What could possibly go wrong? Isn't this wonderful? How convenient, unfortunately, for everyone. They say PS Exec's most powerful uses include launching interactive command prompts on remote systems and remote-enabling tools like IP config that otherwise do not have the ability to show information about remote systems.
Oh, man.
I know. And at this point, once again, we say in unison, what could possibly go wrong? Oh, and it even said, it had a little footer note, some antivirus scanners report that one or more of the tools are infected with a remote admin virus. None of the PS tools contain viruses, but they have been used by viruses, which is why they trigger virus notifications. Yeah. And of course, another example, real quick, I chose the lovely remote utilities solution for my own and for Lori's remote system control needs for the same reasons, that it has also become the remote control solution of choice for nameless miscreants across the internet. It's not its fault, of course, just like a compiler compiles code. It can't help it if the code it's compiling is malware. Okay, so today, Cobalt Strike deserves and receives our attention because it appears that we're just at the beginning of a wave of malicious exploitation, which unfortunately is all being enabled by Cobalt Strike. Back in July, the security firm Proofpoint published and then recently updated a report titled Cobalt Strike, Favorite Tool from APT to Crimeware. Of course, APT, Advanced Persistent Threat. One of the terms we'll encounter today and in the future is beacon or Cobalt Strike beacon. The beacon is the bad bit that's infiltrated into an unwitting victim's machine. And unfortunately, it was quite well designed. Okay, listen to how Cobalt Strike themselves boast about Beacon's capabilities. They write, Beacon is Cobalt Strike's payload to model advanced attackers. Use Beacon to egress a network over HTTP, HTTPS, or DNS. Oh, by the way, also SMB. You may also limit which hosts egress a network by controlling peer-to-peer beacons over Windows-named pipes. Beacon is flexible and supports asynchronous and interactive communication. Asynchronous communication is low and slow. Beacon will phone home, download its tasks, and go to sleep. Interactive communication happens in real time. Beacon's network indicators are malleable. Redefine Beacon's communication with Cobalt Strike's malleable C2, command and control language. This allows you to cloak Beacon activity to look like other malware or blend in as legitimate traffic. And then they go into some additional detail, which would chill the blood of any CISO. They say, right-click on a beacon session and select Interact to open that beacon's console. The console is the main user interface for your beacon session. The beacon console allows you to see which tasks are issued to a beacon and see when it downloads them. The beacon console is also where command output and other information will appear. So, right, a complete happy point-and-click user interface for the bad guys to manage all the beacons that they have managed to install in their victims' machines. Be aware that beacon is an asynchronous payload. Commands do not execute right away. Each command goes into a queue. When the beacon checks in, that is Kinect to you, it will download these commands and execute them one by one. At this time, Beacon will also report any output it has for you. If you make a mistake, use the clear command to clear the command queue for the current beacon. By default, beacons check in every 60 seconds. You may change this with beacon's sleep command. Use sleep followed by a time in seconds to specify how often beacon should check in. You may also specify a second number between 0 and 99. This number is a jitter factor, right? Because to introduce random check-in timings in order to further hide the beacon. Beacon will vary each of its check-in times by the random percentage you specify as a jitter factor. Ah, so it's a percentage. For example, sleep 300 space 20 will force Beacon to sleep for 300 seconds with a 20% jitter percentage. This means Beacon will sleep for a random value between 240 to 300 seconds after each check-in. Ah, so it's unidirectional from the time you specify. To make a Beacon check-in multiple times each second, try sleep 0. This is interactive mode. In this mode, commands will execute right away. You must make your Beacon interactive before you tunnel traffic through it. So it's also a tunneling technology. That's what they meant when they said it will export a network. It will literally export a network connection. A few Beacon commands, browser, pivot, desktop, etc., will automatically put Beacon in interactive mode at the next check-in. So, running commands. Beacon's shell command will task a Beacon to execute a command via command.exe on the compromised host. When the command completes, Beacon will present the output to you. Use the run command to execute a command without command.exe. The run command will post output back to you. The execute command runs a program in the background and does not capture output. Use the PowerShell command to execute a command with PowerShell on the compromised host. Use the PowerPick command to execute PowerShell commandlets without PowerShell.exe. This command relies on the unmanaged PowerShell technique developed by Lee Christensen. The PowerShell and PowerPick commands will use your current security token. The PS inject command will inject unmanaged PowerShell into a specific process and run your commandlet from that process. The PowerShell import command will import a PowerShell script into Beacon. Further uses of the PowerShell, PowerPick, and PS inject commands will have commandlets from the imported script available to them. Beacon will only hold one PowerShell script at a time. Import an empty file to clear the imported script from Beacon. The execute assembly command will run a local .NET executable as a Beacon post-exploitation job. You may pass arguments to this assembly as if it were run from a Windows command line interface. This command will also inherit your current security token. If you want Beacon to execute commands from a specific directory, use the cd command in the Beacon console to switch the working directory of the Beacon's process. The pwd command will tell you which directory you're currently working from. Last but not least, Beacon can execute Beacon object files without creating a new process, because won't that be handy? Beacon object files are compiled C programs written to a specific convention that run within a Beacon session. Use inline execute followed by args to execute a beacon object file with the specified arguments. Use the spawn command to spawn a session for a listener. The spawn command accepts an architecture, for example, x86 or x64, and a listener as arguments. By default, the spawn command will spawn a session in run dll32.exe. An alert administrator may find it strange that run dll32.exe is periodically making connections to the internet. Find a better program, for example, Internet Explorer, and use the spawn2 command to state which program Beacon should spawn sessions to. The spawn2 command requires you to specify an architecture, x86, x64, and a full path to a program to spawn as needed. Type spawn2 by itself and press Enter to instruct Beacon to go back to its default behavior. Type inject, followed by a process ID and a listener name to inject a session into a specific process. Use PS to get a list of processes on the current system. Use inject PID x64 to inject a 64-bit beacon into an x64 process. The spawn and inject commands both inject a payload stage into memory. If the payload stage is an HTTP, HTTPS, or DNS beacon and it can't reach you, you will not see a session. If the payload stage is a bind TCP or SMB beacon, these commands will automatically try to link to and assume control of these payloads. Use DLL inject PID to inject a reflective DLL into a specific process by process ID. Use the shinject PID architecture and path command to inject shell code from a local file into a process on the target. Use sh spawn architecture and path to spawn the spawn2 process and inject the specified shell code into the process. Use DLL load process ID and path to load an on-disk DLL into another process of your choice. Use PPID and then PID to assign an alternate parent process for programs run by your beacon session. This is a means to make your activity blend in with normal actions on the target. These guys could not have written a more potent, horrifying tool for bad guys to have gotten a hold of. And I won't keep going. There's the run NU, the spawn NU, and others. This is a dream come true for the underworld. It was deliberately and consciously designed by advanced cybersecurity experts specifically to operate as covertly as possible using every advanced trick in the book. And it's now loose, being proactively used not for red versus blue team training, but in the wild by threat actors. And its use is spreading, not just in depth, but dramatically in breadth. Here's what Proofpoint describes and found. They said, in December 2020, the world learned about an expansive and effective espionage campaign that successfully backdoored the popular network monitoring software, wait for it, SolarWinds. Investigators revealed tools used by the threat actors, including Cobalt Strike Beacon. In other words, Cobalt Strike Beacon, the malicious use of it, was behind the now infamous SolarWinds attacks. This campaign, they wrote, was attributed to threat actors working for Russia's Foreign Intelligence Service, a group with Cobalt Strike in their toolbox since at least 2018. This high-profile activity was part of a clever attack chain enabling advanced threat actors to surreptitiously compromise a relatively small number of victims. The tool used and customized to fit their needs is almost, meaning Cobalt Strike Beacon, is almost a decade old, but increasingly popular. Cobalt Strike debuted in 2012 in response to perceived gaps in an existing red team tool, the Metasploit framework. In 2015, Cobalt Strike 3.0 launched as a standalone adversary emulation platform. By 2016, Proofpoint researchers began observing threat actors using Cobalt Strike. Historically, Cobalt Strike used in malicious operations was largely associated with well-resourced threat actors, including large cybercrime operators like TA-3546, also known as FIN7, and APT groups such as TA-423, also known as Leviathan or APT-40. Proofpoint researchers have attributed two-thirds of identified Cobalt Strike campaigns from 2016 through 2018 to well-resourced cybercrime organizations or APT groups. That ratio decreased dramatically the following years. Between 2019 and present, just 15%, down from 66, 15% of Cobalt Strike campaigns were attributable to known threat actors. In other words, the word got out that Cobalt Strike was the tool to use. And after running through that command reference, of course, and everyone began picking it up and using it. Proofpoint notes that, quote, threat actors can obtain Cobalt Strike in a variety of ways, purchasing it directly from the vendor's website, which requires verification, buying a version on the dark web via various hacking forums, or using cracked illegitimate versions of the software. In March 2020, a cracked version of Cobalt Strike 4.0 was released and made available to threat actors. And in making even more clear the appeal that Cobalt Strike offers, Proofpoint explains, Cobalt Strike is used by a diverse array of threat actors, and while it is not unusual for cybercriminal and APT actors to leverage similar tooling in their campaigns, Cobalt Strike is unique in that its built-in capabilities enable it to be quickly deployed and operationalized regardless of actor sophistication or access to human or financial resources. Cobalt Strike, in other words, you don't need to be a genius to use it, you don't need a team, and you don't need any money. Cobalt Strike is also session-based. That is, if threat actors can access a host and complete an operation without needing to establish ongoing presence, there will not be remaining artifacts on the host after it is no longer running in memory. And remember, that's what we saw with the earlier SolarWinds hacks, right? It was very hard to get attribution because these things were very careful to erase their footprints. Cobalt Strike is what, you know, it was designed to do that. So in essence, they said they can hit it and forget it. Threat actors, they continue, can also use the malleability of Cobalt Strike to create customized builds that add or remove features to achieve objectives or evade detection. For example, APT-29 frequently uses custom Cobalt Strike beacon loaders to blend in with legitimate traffic or evade analysis. For defenders, customized Cobalt Strike modules often require unique signatures, so threat detection engineers may be required to play catch-up with Cobalt Strike use in the wild. Cobalt Strike is also appealing to threat actors for its inherent obfuscation. Attribution gets more difficult if everyone is using the same tool. If an organization has a red team actively making use of it, it's possible malicious traffic could be mistaken as legitimate. The software's ease of use can improve the capabilities of less sophisticated actors. For sophisticated actors, why spend development cycles on something new when you already have a great tool for the job? Proofpoint data shows Cobalt Strike is a popular tool for everything from strategic compromises to noisy, widespread campaigns. So, we have a top-of-the-line tool which was designed to enable good guys to stealthily penetrate and inhabit their own networks for the purpose of testing and training anti-penetration and intrusion detection teams. It licenses for $3,500 per seat. On the other hand, it got loose, was cracked, it's now on the dark web for free, and it's out of control from its publisher. Now, this highly professional, high-end tool, would have ever been able to create for themselves, is freely available, being used in the wild on a much more than daily basis. Mm. There is little doubt that we'll be encountering the term Cobalt Strike in the future. Now, at least, we'll all know exactly what it means and entails when we talk about it. Wow.
David Redekop in our discourse, our Club Twit discourse, says...
Oh, cool. Hi, David.
Yay. Hey, David. He says you can easily block Cobalt Strike C2 connections because CSC2 hosts never use domain names, only hard-coded IP addresses, which is, I think, what you'd expect with a pen test tool. You're not going to do DNS on it. You're going to enter the IP address, so you just disallow traffic that wasn't first resolved by DNS.
Yeah, but that's tricky. That's going to require filter. Yeah. David has a lot of experience with running local small DNS servers, and yeah. I would imagine if he's saying that, he has a filter that's smart enough to do that as part of his offering.
Yeah, yeah. He says Pegasus did that as well. It's nice to have smart people in our chat. If you're not a Club Twit member and you want to hang in there with some of the smartest people watching the show, you can easily join Club Twit, get free ad-free versions of this show and all our others, and access to the Discord server, which is a great place to be all the time. And in fact, I spend a lot of time in there. And also, of course, the Twit Plus feed. Just go to twit.tv/clubtwit. You want to get a copy of this show? I'll tell you how you can do that. A couple of ways. You can go to Steve's site first. That's grc.com. He has 16 kilobit audio for the bandwidth impaired, 64 kilobit audio for those with ears. He also has transcripts for those with eyes, nicely written. You can use them to read along while you're listening, to read standalone, or to use for search. In fact, that's one of the best benefits of the transcripts. It allows searching for a specific part of any show, all 837. And going right to that part of the show. Thanks for doing that, Steve. We appreciate it. And Elaine Ferris, who does those transcriptions. Steve also has a copy waiting for you of something called SpinRite. Perhaps you've heard of it. Version 6 is current, the world's best mass storage maintenance and recovery utility. You can also, if you get 6.0 now, get a free upgrade to 6.1 and kind of follow along with the developments.
It was really cool listening to Adrian on that YouTube video. He was so matter-of-factly talked about it. He was like, and then I inhaled, and he said, you know, and then I ran SpinRite on. It's like, wow, it was so cool.
It's actually amazing. I guess it's because he works with his vintage equipment that he remembered that, oh yeah, I could fix the interleave. Just run SpinRite. It'll pick a better interleave level. Yeah. That's so cool. Yeah. You can also catch the show on our website. That is twit.tv/SN for Security Now. There's a full-time YouTube channel with all the episodes. And you can also watch it live. I think a lot of people like to watch it happen live. You're more than welcome to. We have live audio and video streams at twit.tv/live. If you are watching live, get in the Discord with our Club Twit members or our free IRC channel, irc.twit.tv. You can watch and chat at the same time. After the fact, the website, YouTube, you might have conversations with other Twit members in our forums. That's twit.community or our Mastodon instance, twit.social. There are lots of places you can interact with the family of Twits. Of course, Steve has his own forums at grc.com. We do the show of a Tuesday afternoon right after Mac Break Weekly, usually somewhere between 1:30 and 2 p.m. Pacific. That's 4:30 Eastern. That's 20:30 UTC. And although I guess are some countries off summertime already? I think they might be. And but we're still on summertime until after Halloween, until October.
Yep.
Yabba dabba doo. Somebody hey. Listening says I need a copy of Spin Right right now.
Thank
That's
you.
Awesome. thank you, Steve. Have a wonderful week. Enjoy Foundation.
Oh, we'll be talking about it next Tuesday.
Well, that means I have to watch two. You're going to watch all three episodes. All right, I will too. All right. Thanks, Steve.
Okay,
take care.
Bye.
Android is constantly evolving, and if you're part of the Android faithful, then you'll be just as excited about it as I am. I'm Jason Howell, host of All About Android, along with my co-hosts Florence Ion and Ron Richards, where every week we cover the news, we cover the hardware, and we cover the apps that are driving the Android ecosystem. Plus, we invite people who are writing about Android, talking about Android, and making Android onto the show. Every Tuesday at twit.tv, look for All About Android. Security now.